From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the program, how efforts to reshape downtown Milwaukee could take a page from the success of reshaping downtown Phoenix. Plus, a journalist uses the online Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service as material for his graduate thesis on journalism and community building.
While there's nothing dramatic about it, there is evidence that what's being reported on NNS is being carried over from neighborhood to neighborhood to neighborhood.
And why it's worth playing in Nashville when you're not a country band.
Just everyone likes making really good music there, writing, working on your craft and learning from each other. And so no matter what genre you're in, you just take a lot from when you grow a ton. And if you want to get better, it's the best place to be because you're inspired by so many legends that are just hanging out there.
Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today. Wisconsin Avenue sometimes feels like two different worlds. East of the river, the downtown thrives on weekdays, workers filling office buildings, restaurants filled with diners, tourists heading for the lakefront museums. But the stretch of Wisconsin Avenue between the Milwaukee River and Marquette University is laconic in comparison. At the center of the issue is the troubled Shops of Grand Avenue. The mall has seen national retailers depart and only mixed success with local businesses that have filled some of the vacancies. The space was in the news over the spring for two reasons. First, that a local group says it plans to bid on the property with an eye towards making it a mixed-use development. And second, with the word that the YMCA, which filed for bankruptcy recently, plans to sell and move out of its space in the mall. One leading expert suggests we should look west, way west, at a downtown success story for potential guidance. Duke Reiter is Senior Vice President and Managing Director of the Solutions Initiative at the Arizona State University Foundation. He was instrumental in a plan that helped revitalize what was a troubled downtown Phoenix. And he joined us by phone from Arizona in June. Welcome to the show.
Delighted to be here.
Let me start you with a broad question. What do successful efforts to reinvigorate city downtowns have in common?
I would say a sense of realism. I think imagining that you can import something wonderful that you might have seen in one city and believe that it's replicable in another is a fallacy. So you have to be careful. I'm sort of amused by how many cities around the country, if not the world, would like to have a quote-unquote high line in their city because of the success of that elevated park in New York City on an old train trestle. And now there are high-line imitators around the country. The circumstances that come together to make a place what it is are unique to that place. And I think you have to look very hard and close at what you have as assets and maybe liabilities as well, and then go from there.
Would you say things often go wrong when you take something that really isn't native to that place and try to inflict it on that place, if you will?
I think that the results would show that most of the outcomes are less than optimal. I think there's, again, a belief that the transplantation of certain things into a city will cause everything around it to change. And I think you have to be very careful about what you choose to import into your city. But if you can possibly look really closely at what assets you already have, and that would include the human capital, you know, the people who are there, what their interests are, what they're already indicating they would like to see happen in their city, and then work with that in addition to bringing in, of course, quality ideas from other places based on precedent. That's always a good idea. But I think you do it in a way that really has a degree of authenticity, that it seems to be of that place.
What about the idea of incrementalism versus, sort of big sweeping change happening all at once? I mean, do cities succeed if they do it quickly, or is it something that really has to take place over a long period of time?
I think there were opportunities, as we saw in Paris or elsewhere, under completely different kind of leadership regimes where kings and others could transform cities whole cloth. We don't live in that kind of circumstance, and maybe happily so. I think if you try to do too much at one time, that is unlikely to succeed. Cities are necessarily a reflection of history. Things usually accrete and are developed amongst generations, not simply by a single gesture, by a single person or entity. So I think one has to be careful to go at an appropriate pace. That doesn't mean one shouldn't be ambitious. Every mayor is a city planner in chief, and hopefully he or she does have great expectations for his or her respective city and tries to bring things into those cities to cause them to happen. But I think pace is something that needs to be very carefully understood.
If I understand correctly, one of the key stories you'll share in Milwaukee is the catalyzing role that ASU played in turning around downtown Phoenix. And I was hoping you'd at least share that story in a nutshell with us. What was that city's downtown up against when the efforts began?
Well, and I have spent time in Milwaukee, and you have an incredible stock of historic buildings and quite a bit of activity in various parts of the city. Phoenix is a much younger place. Doesn't have as many buildings of architectural note. And given that we are a sprawling metropolis and we are not the only downtown in the area, there are 32 municipalities here, and I would say a good 10 or 12 of them all aspire to have thriving downtowns. So even the question of our downtown and its focus, position as a focal point in the valley was not obvious. So we are the largest university in the United States. We're about 76,000-77,000 students at this point. And we have a strong, if not unprecedented, commitment to the development of the region. We feel it's our obligation. We are the essential university in this area, and that puts us in a unique position to do some really wonderful things. And we felt that our university and its profile needed to be registered in the downtown Phoenix landscape. The mayor wanted to see more people on the streets, wanted to see retail thriving, wanted to see housing being built to accommodate people. And we needed buildings to accommodate this growing student population. We also wanted some of our programs, like journalism, to be close to the television stations, and our nursing school to be close to the hospital, and our College of Public Programs to be close to the seats of county, city, and state government. So it was really a win-win situation. We wanted to be downtown. The city wanted us to be there, and the taxpayers of Phoenix voted favorably over 2-1 to put forward about $220 million via a bond election to help a state university. Again, these are citizens of a city helping to bring a state institution downtown. And with that money, we bought land, we built buildings, we renovated buildings, we built parks. And today we have approximately 12,000 students in the downtown area. We're planning for more. Now we're moving our law school and everything associated with that downtown. So it's been a success and a win for all parties.
The lesson, though, I gather, is not necessarily that you need a university to develop a downtown corridor.
You don't need a university. However, universities are, by their very nature, optimistic places. They're forward-thinking. They're about building knowledge. They're about helping students have the wherewithal to be successful in their careers and or build businesses. So there's something really positive about a university. It does have people who move between buildings and has sort of a spark all of its own. And there are no great cities, I would suggest, without great universities at their cores. So if you had to pick something at this moment in time that was going to bring life to a downtown area and cause other things to happen around it, you'd be hard-pressed to think about what that might be that would be better than a university. It could be an extremely progressive company that has ambitions to do some other things. I would point out, as many people have, what Tony Hsieh has done with Zappos in old downtown Las Vegas. I look at what Dan Gilbert is doing with Pick a Loan in Detroit. But universities are nevertheless always present, even in those cities, and they're important catalysts for change.
What can you tell us about the consensus building process? You know, knowing what I do about Arizona, it's a fairly conservative electorate in much of the state. How did you go about building support for essentially a public project at a time when a lot of public projects are pretty routinely shot down?
Well, while Arizona, and we certainly find ourselves in the news nationally, not always for the reasons that maybe we would like, probably has what you might call a conservative cast. But cities generally are pretty progressive places. We typically have a Democratic mayor in Phoenix, and I'm not suggesting that a Republican mayor would not have seen the value of this had he or she been in office.
Sure.
But the city is a little bit different than the state, as large cities or university cities often are within their states. I probably went to some 150 public meetings, as did I know the president of the university, as did the mayor, as did many other citizens representing this idea. The business community certainly came out in force. And so through a bond election process, you're required to essentially campaign to cause voters to say, yes, I want to support these enterprises with regard to, in this case, the university. But they're also voting on other quality of life issues, parks, fire, police, whatever else the city needs. And the voters, in their wisdom, said, you know, this is the right thing for us for the long term. It would be great to have our university, one of the premier universities in the country, thriving. That's where we think a lot of economic benefit is going to come from in the future. And it would be good also for the physical environs of the city. So they were obviously convinced. If you're winning an election these days 2-1, that's a pretty overwhelming support for an idea.
How hard was it to get to the point where you had a bond issue to put in front of the voters? I mean, sometimes these are issues that can be discussed to death. What does it take to actually begin to move the ball?
Well, Phoenix has a reputation for being extraordinarily well run as a municipality. It's received many awards for the way that City Hall is managed, and it's a quite high quality operation. They had had bond elections often occurring maybe every 5 or so years. That was pre-downturn, pre-recession. So these things came up regularly, and it was a chance for the voters in the area to talk about what they wanted their city to be. So you can assume that that structure was in place. But as you build a bond election, you do have to decide where you're going to put your resources. I think for this bond election, of which we were a part, I think it was in the neighborhood of $850 million. They had probably $2 to $3 billion worth of requests of things that should be funded. So the process requires the citizens and various committees. The whole project was led by a former mayor to sort of look at what they want to be, what are they going to be able to afford to do. And in the end, they decide that nearly a quarter of this particular bond election should go to the building of an advanced component of Arizona State University in the downtown.
Well, what's to say that this vision for what a downtown could be is more sustainable than the downtowns that existed years ago and then faded?
Well, the great thing about universities, which is part of the question you asked earlier, why a university, or is a university the only way to go? And certainly it's not the only way to go. But, you know, we're incredibly durable. Universities don't go away. And especially ours, which has been increasing in quality, size, and scope at an incredibly rapid rate. We only became a university in about 1960. And that also was due to a vote of the citizens of the state. So we are going to continue to expand. We have no doubt that we'll probably hit 100,000 students in the not-too-distant future based on the growth of the Latino population and other people moving into this area. So unlike other circumstances where maybe you bet on a particular company, or maybe you bet on a stadium, or maybe something else that just didn't have the same staying power, I suppose, and we have all kinds of examples, and you've got many in the Midwest where I'm from as well, where certain things have certainly changed from what they were 50, 40, 30, even 20 years ago. But to bet that the university will still be going strong decades from now is probably a pretty good bet. So I'd say this is certainly the right thing to do. Other economic things around us could change, and we are very much like Milwaukee. We think about what globalization is doing to Phoenix and how we can remain relevant, if not extremely relevant. And so the arguments for how to revive and or make vital Midwestern cities and the conversations we're having here are remarkably similar. interesting enough, many people have pointed to the role of universities in making sure that our cities are thriving and can compete globally. They're thinking about the engineers produced by universities, the other kinds of discoveries that turn into inventions, that turn into companies. I think it's the best way to go, if you will, to think about the future of your place through your university.
Well, Duke Reiter, thank you so much for spending some time with us and shedding some additional light on the issue for us.
Delighted to be here, Mr.
Duke Reiter is Senior Vice President and Managing Director for the Solutions Initiative at the Arizona State University Foundation. He and Phoenix Mayor Greg Stanton spoke to members of the Greater Milwaukee Committee in June about how the revitalization of downtown Phoenix could inform similar efforts in Milwaukee. The Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service is the subject of an academic analysis by journalist Herbert Lowe. We'll find out what his study revealed about the news service's place in the modern journalism universe when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke. The online Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service has been operating for 3 years with support from places such as the Zilber Neighborhood Initiative, United Neighborhood Centers of Milwaukee, and Marquette University. Among the outlet's missions has been to cover hyper-local neighborhood stories that are often missed by larger publications with broader scopes. They've often shared those stories with us right here on Lake Effect. But have the outlet's ambitions really been realized? And how does the Neighborhood News Service itself figure into the work of community building? Herbert Lowe is the professional in residence and director of journalism for social change at Marquette University's Diedrich College of Communication. The news service was the topic of his recently completed master's thesis, and he's with us in the studio along with journalism professor John Pauly and NNS editor-in-chief Sharon McGowan. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
What led you to study the Neighborhood News Service in an academic way in the first place?
I was pursuing my master's degree, and a thesis was one of the options. I actually was going to do a professional project on another topic, and a wise man suggested that I do something more intellectually robust. And when I asked him if he had any ideas, the very next thought was, you should do a case study of the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service. And that struck me as really odd because I didn't know a thesis could be directly across the hall from me because the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service was directly across from my office. And I had been engaged with its staff and particularly Sharon McGowan as a journalism faculty member and who has had 22 years of journalism experience. And so clearly as a member of its editorial advisory board, an advocate for it and it, the students engage with it and what it's trying to do in the community. And then when someone who you respect and is the most intellectual man tells you that this is something you should do, you have to do it. So,
John Pauly, what was it about the Neighborhood News Service that you thought lent itself to such an academically and intellectually rigorous approach?
I thought there were two things. One is that there's a long history of discussion in journalism about the relationship between journalism and community. And so we had a really lively experiment right on our doorstep. And the second is even for all of the struggles in the journalism profession, now this is a moment of tremendous energy within the profession and experimentation. And I thought that this would be a good case study to pursue to see what's happening in Milwaukee in relationship to larger national trends.
Well, why me?
You were the right man for the job. Well, you have a passion for the community side and some personal history and professional history with that. So I thought that you were well positioned to do it.
And so in a nutshell, what was the question you were trying to answer with this work in terms of the nexus of the Neighborhood News Service and community?
Well, what was it that they intended to do? What was it that people – how were people responding to it? What were the people who were engaged with it learning about it? and what exactly was the work that was being done.
Sharon McGowan, how would you describe the community mission of the Neighborhood News Service?
Well, I think that the most important thing is that we're professional, objective journalists covering the communities. But I have been persuaded, and I'm beginning to understand, that the notion of more community engagement is apparently the future. And the more I think about it, the more excited I am about it, because I think that we are doing a good job in a traditional sense, but there's no reason why we can't push the envelope and be a little more experimental.
Herbert Lowe, how do you measure the creation of community, if you will?
Well, geography, political aspirations, basically who lives near you or is trying to have the same matters of quality of life that you are and the energies that are around them. For communities such as NNS focuses on
This is like 17 neighborhoods.
Yes, 17 neighborhoods in the central city of Milwaukee. It's about being able to improve the qualities of life that everyone should have in terms of public safety, education, being able to walk and on your streets and feeling safe. It is not any different from those who are in communities in the suburbs. The work that the NNS is doing relates to being able to show that there are people fully engaged in improving the quality of life and that it is worth investing in if you have resources or money to do so.
Chair McGowan.
Yes, I think Herb did a really good job describing community. The way that I heard your question, though, is how can you measure whether what we're doing has any effect on community? And I think that that's the big research question that would need to be answered. I don't think anybody knows how to do that exactly. And if there were some kind of standard by which we could measure ourselves.
If there were an algorithm that allowed you to connect the dots that says, because of this reporting, this has been the impact on the quality of life in this neighborhood, that would be great.
Right. I think that it's a very good question and one that we think about a lot, but I don't think we figured out how to do it.
Right. But as Sharon, you said in your interview with me and as we researched for the thesis, there are many organizations in these 17 neighborhoods that see work or stories on NNS that they then can go and either relink to their sites. Here's a good idea that's working in this neighborhood. Maybe we could try it in ours. And so while there's nothing dramatic about it, but there is evidence that what's being reported on NNS is being carried over from neighborhood to neighborhood to neighborhood.
John Pauley, this is kind of an eternal question that journalists have had. Does my work have an impact?
Yeah, and I think there are different places where you can look for the impact. And so I think in the initial question, it's harder to prove citizen by citizen in the neighborhoods what the impact is. But I think the last point Herb was making was really crucial, that the impact has been on the leaders within these communities, that there are people of vision and passion and ability in smaller scale organizations that aren't entirely visible within larger mainstream media. And the Neighborhood News Service has given them a chance to make their another opportunity for leadership and then connecting across those groups. And so it is building the network of leadership, I think, at that point. And there's still more to be said and thought about in terms of the effect on individual citizens within.
Part of what we looked at was the sources for the stories that NNS covered. Many scholars have said that journalists often will go to what comes out of City Hall or officials' sources and go straight to someone's doorstep and see what you think about it. There's also the notion of conflict and tension that drives the news. And what the Neighborhood News Service is doing is writing stories that show that leaders can happen right from people who have no education at all or who simply just want to keep, as one of the mothers that Dunn did that, I believe it is the story, they simply just want to keep their kids from being target practice for people with guns. And so the quasi-official neighborhood groups where they get most of their stories from private public places. These are places that NNS is getting to that the Journal Sentinel, maybe Lake Effect or other Milwaukee magazine, they simply don't have the resources to go into these places. And so these are stories that need to be told but otherwise aren't getting told. And what NNS is doing differently than if we touch on community journalism, NNS is doing it at a quality of presentation and reporting that you don't see in an organization of this size.
Sharon McGowan, how do you build the community building issue into the kinds of training that your journalists are getting?
I don't think I focus on that. What I focus on is teaching them, if they don't already know, how to find a source, report a story, write a story, do a video or audio slideshow about a story, and then make sure that the quality is high enough to publish. That said, I don't ever bring on an intern who I think is not interested really in covering the communities that we cover. There's a lot of people who want this on their resume, but if they don't show some interest in what we do, then it's not a good fit.
John Pauley, is this representative of a bigger emphasis in community involvement among journalists who are coming up through the ranks today?
I think it's really important for journalists to be self-reflective about their mode of address to the community. And I think we take that for granted. We know what those routines and habits look like traditionally in journalism in relationship to the people that Herb was describing as official sources. So one of the things that's important in this kind of journalism is putting yourself in the neighborhood and having a respect for that, being willing to listen to a different kind of voice, being willing to hear the stories that matter to people. And I think that's something that journalism, just as in general as an institution right now, is trying to think through in all of its forms. So what does it mean to have journalism matter to the community for these people? What would it take for us to do that kind of work that would make it matter deeply to them?
Well, and I wonder if some of this is what sets apart organizations like the Neighborhood News Service and to some degree local newspapers in general from the national news services that everybody is on all the time on their computers and their smartphones and wherever else they get their news.
Yeah, I think that it's very important to understand that our reporters, whether they're the professional reporters, we have right now three professional reporters, they are not youngsters, they're all experienced, and they are the core of our reporting staff. They and the interns have to be in the neighborhoods in order to do this reporting. You cannot do this reporting on the phone, although sometimes they try, but it's clearly obvious. You have to be there. You have to talk to people. And you should be bringing back another story because every time you talk to somebody or a group of people, you should be finding another story. And that holds for everybody from the most experienced reporter to the newest intern.
Herbert Lowe, let's flash forward through all of this work that you did. What's the overarching takeaway message that you want to get out there and hope that your research gets out into the community that the Neighborhood News Service is covering?
Across this nation, the industry that we know as journalism is changing, and there are more stories to tell but fewer people in position to tell them. And as legacy news organizations have to rethink what stories they're going to be able to tell and how they're going to be able to tell them, if communities and journalism education programs are able to come together through grant funding or other means, that it is possible to tell great stories and dynamically presented about matters involving quality of life in neighborhoods such as the kinds that Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service is doing, and that it can be done excellently, and that stories matter, and how they're told matter, and who tells them matter. One thing that we haven't said here is that most of the professional staff that Sharon engages with are from the communities. Edgar Mendez, for example, grew up on the South Side, went to UWM, earned his journalism degree, was desperate to get into journalism, and the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service in Marquette enabled him to get the experience he needed to now earn an internship this summer at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and he will have a master's degree while at it. And so these are opportunities that can be replicated in communities such as ours across the nation. And if people want to see what is happening here, they can read this. We've had some other consultants look at the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service and advise Sharon and the Editorial Advisory Board and the College of Communication on how to be of the community, not just report about the community, and just figuring out how to do the great journalism objectively and professionally as Sharon demands, but also increase the audience, increase not just within the community but externally as well.
How does this work play into the question of the news service's sustainability? It was created through some initial grants, which are coming to the end of their cycle.
They are coming to the end of their cycle. We expect most of them to be renewed. We sold our first ad this week, which I think it's going to bring in about $20, but it's a start.
The throwback to high school journalism.
Right. So we are focusing very much on sustainability. We're in the process of figuring out how to hire somebody whose sole responsibility will be the business side, marketing, and fundraising, which is not my expertise and it's not what I want to do. So I'm excited about that.
I would make the case that NNS needs more personality, that it needs to have faces, much like Gregory Stanford or Eugene Cain or James Causey, notable columnists of color, black columnists for the Journal Sentinel, have created a presence in the community, in the communities that the Journal Sentinel serves. I maintain that the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service needs people. We, in this day and age, for better or for worse, news agencies are identified by personalities, whether it's cable, talk shows, or legacy news organizations. And so that is important. The second concern that must be noted that is that Sharon McGowan is shouldering an incredible amount of responsibility regarding editing and marketing, and she's basically the life of NNS. And I'd love to be able to see her get some editorial support. Love to see her be able to take a vacation. I just love to be able to know that if Sharon McGowan was to win the lottery and didn't want to work this hard anymore, that there would be someone else who can make sure that this great work continues.
I will second that opinion. Herbert Lowe, Sharon McGowan, John Pauley, thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thanks,
thank
Mitch.
You.
Best of luck.
Thank you.
Sharon McGowan is editor-in-chief of the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service. John Pauley is a professor of journalism at Marquette University's Diedrich College of Communication. And Herbert Lowe is professional in residence at the college. His recently completed master's thesis is on the Neighborhood News Service. In the interest of full disclosure, I was among the people he interviewed for that thesis. Our interview first aired in June. Next on the show, a Nashville band whose sound is less Grand Ole Opry and more about the wide open spaces of the American West. The duo Escondido performs in Lake Effect Studio C when we return on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect Now, I'm Mitch Teich. Escondido's sound brings to mind the open spaces of the American West, though the band actually calls the music-intensive city of Nashville home. The duo features the harmonies of Tyler James and Jessica Maros, who were in Milwaukee earlier this spring to play at Mad Planet. While they were here, they inaugurated our recently revamped performance studio with a performance of their song Cold October from their debut album, The Ghost of Escondido. It's a cold October. Yeah, that's the old me talking, the new me's walking. Some hearts are dismayed for locking, darling. It's a cold October. It's a cold October. It's gonna be a cold October. It's gonna be a cold October. Cold October, that's Escondido in WWM Studio C1. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And what a killer song.
Thank you.
Before we go any further, let's have you each introduce yourselves. Tell us who you are and what you're playing.
My name is Tyler, and I'm singing and playing electric guitar and tambourine with my foot.
I'm Jessica, and I play acoustic guitar and sing.
And I'm Grant, and I play the bass.
Well, welcome to all three of you. What do you take as the inspiration for your sound? I mean, Cold October sounds like it could have been at home on a Fleetwood Mac album in 1979, but there are other tracks on your most recent CD that could easily be in a Western movie circa 1965, and then there are some that kind of defy easy categorization. What was it that drove the sound of this band?
All of those things. We like 70s and 60s AM radio stuff, and we love being inspired by all the great spaghetti western soundtracks for our music, and we listen to a lot of chill stuff and a lot of rock and roll, crazy psychedelic stuff. So,
I mean, I think it was, you know, when Tyler and I met, a lot of the songs, it started with the song, and then after the song, you know, Tyler just had all these really awesome ideas about creating this sort of spaghetti western sound around the song. So that's kind of where it ended up.
Well, and did I read that you actually met, when you and Tyler met, you were actually sitting there strumming a guitar, is that right?
Yeah, a friend of ours introduced each other, and I was actually there singing a song for her and her song.
I was recording a Christmas song for a friend of ours.
And and she was like, Jess, play him Rodeo Queen. And I played Rodeo Queen. And that night I walked away with this awesome kind of track. We tracked it that night. And I was like, wow.
This is horrible.
This is the worst thing I've ever heard in my life. Never working with that guy again.
Wow. This is worse than Chumbawamba.
That is the second time Chumbawamba has been referenced in our office in like the last week, which is
wow.
Two more times than it has been referenced in like 5 years.
It's coming back.
90s are back.
Well, and Rodeo Queen has this great kind of brass, almost mariachi sound to it.
I didn't bring the trumpet we had in the car, but we didn't have any songs that were playing trumpet on today.
Well, yeah, and trumpet is kind of, is totally, totally different than the sound we just heard.
Yeah, but I think there's one common theme through the whole thing, and it's, you know, we love reverb, and we love trumpets, and we love the desert.
You mentioned tracking Rodeo Queen, but the album itself, The Ghost of Escondido, you recorded in one day.
Yeah.
What was that like?
It was cool. We spent a couple months, after that first day meeting, probably a week later, we started meeting more regularly and spent about a couple months working on the songs and kind of doing all pre-production. And then the night before the studio, I gathered like three of our musician friends. We rehearsed kind of the demos we had done, and then the next day we didn't know it was going to happen. We knew that our drummer
like
that day.
10 hour.
We knew our drummer that day had another gig that night, like at 8 p.m. So we got in there at 10 and started at noon and did like three takes of every song. And then I kind of just pieced together all that stuff.
We tried to do it again and it didn't work. So it was definitely something special that happened that day. It was just, you know, I thought a lot about it. And the guys that Tyler brought together, we barely knew each other. And so it was sort of like this moment of not really knowing each other, but yet really respecting each other. And then we took risks, and it was really fun.
Is there a certain spontaneity you think you were able to capture in doing it just
Absolutely.
In that one quick session?
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's kind of the point of it too, is not only to save money, but we had spent so much time making a pretty highly stylized record, and I wanted to just, you know, smooth off some of the too stylized things. If you do it in a day, you can't really, it ends up sounding like whatever these five people in a room sound like, no matter how much you've planned it to sound a certain way. So it turned out pretty good.
Well, the next track you're going to play is, I think, one of the songs that you recorded that day. Tell us a little bit about what we're going to hear next.
Yeah, it's called Bad Without You. And I wrote, the idea came from doing things that the person you love doesn't like. We've all been through there. We've all had
that experience. I've never done that.
Okay.
All right, here we go.
Bad Without You, Escondido in Studio C1. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We think of Nashville as this center for country music. What do you get from being in Nashville when you are not a country act?
You get a lot of great, just everyone likes making really good music there, writing, working on your craft and learning from each other. And so no matter what genre you're in, you just take a lot from it and you grow a ton. And if you want to get better, it's the best place to be because you're inspired by so many legends that are just hanging out there.
I think it's like a mecca of songwriting too. You know, a lot of people visit Nashville to become, just like you said, a better musician and all. And it's a great place of meeting people and, you know, front porch guitar hangs.
Well, and I wonder if there's some expanding of musical horizons that goes on just by everybody having access to everybody else.
Oh, there's so much. I mean, I think there's a huge underground scene happening right now.
It's not an underground scene. It's probably as big as the country music scene. I mean, all around the world, people know about Nashville now, and most of them aren't talking about Conway Twitty or Travis Tritt. Well, even though that's pretty good country music, I like that stuff.
Well, and Tyler, you have done a lot of solo work. You've played with a variety of other bands. Where do you see Escondido in comparison to everything else you have done?
So far, it's been a lot more fun just like hanging out with us three.
You sure about that?
It's hard work. Being a solo artist is also hard, but you get to make all the decisions yourself. But it's really nice to have a partner in crime. And I think after I played with this band, Edward Sharp, for a while, I got to feel what it was like to be in a bigger community of people on stage. And it was so much more relaxing and fun. And having other people that kind of get your back and depend on for stuff has been awesome. And not singing leads, pretty fun too.
Well, and Jessica, you have been around music for a long time, but if I understand right, before this record, you were around music more than you were playing music. You actually work as a fashion designer, is that right?
Yeah, actually, I came to Nashville to do music. I had like a small development deal, and I wrote a whole bunch of songs and made a couple albums. I just never liked them and never released anything. And so Escondido is the first thing I ever released. And then, yeah, I kind of quit music a little bit and started a fashion company and then, you know, made clothes and jewelry and all that fun stuff. But
if you were to draw the Venn diagram of music and design, is there an overlap between those two kinds of artistic output?
Yeah, definitely. You know, fashion's a form of expression, and so
it's all creative. So
you want to, when you wake up in the morning, it's how you feel. I don't think you should box yourself in with anything you do. I think if you do, then you're boring. There's a lot more business involved in fashion. I mean, there's a lot of business in music, but I think that just business overall in fashion, I felt like I was kind of losing myself as an artist. So music's just a lot better of an outlet for me.
So as we're having this conversation, you have done shows, what, 10 nights in a row?
Yeah, this is our
first day off tomorrow.
When you're playing that many dates in a row, is it energizing at all or just tiring?
It is energizing. Every night's so different, so you never know what to expect, and it kind of throws you off for a loop, especially when you're tired.
Yeah.
You're like, how am I going to respond to this one? You know,
you're constantly exhausted, but sometimes you show up and the show actually goes way better because of that, and it's just rock and roll. And other times you feel like you're going to faint. And
has that happened yet?
Last night I was like my first beer of the day, and I had like a sip of beer, and I kind of stumbled. I was like almost like partly fainted, and people in the crowd probably thought I was like drunk or something. It's like, no, but I couldn't. I didn't attempt to explain myself because we started the next song. So
it's like a Spinal Tap moment.
Yeah, just going around.
Spontaneous combustion.
Our fourth drummer couldn't be here today.
Well, I'm grateful none of you have spontaneously combusted while you're in our studio today.
Yeah, me too.
Tyler, Jessica, and Grant, thank you so much to
thank
all
you.
Three of you, and best of luck.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
And tell us what you're going to play us out with.
This is a song we've been playing just on this tour for the first time by the Everly Brothers called When Will I Be Loved. Thank you.
Tyler James and Jessica Maros are the duo Escondido. They're based in Nashville. They joined us in the studio this spring on a recent national tour. Their debut album, The Ghost of Escondido, came out last year. They're currently working on their follow-up. They take us out with a cover of the Everly Brothers classic, When Will I Be Loved? That's all for another edition of Lake Effect. Don't forget, when we're not on the air, you can find us online. Listen to segments, see pictures and videos, and find links at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. I'm Mitch Teich. So great to have you listening today. Thanks for tuning in, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. It's 11 o'clock. Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next. When I find